This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hi, and welcome to this post-Christmas show. Here at the podcast crew, we hope you all had a wonderful family Christmas, and we're all looking forward to a much better 2021 and get this past year behind us. Hey, I'm going to be off for a couple weeks, so this week and next week, what I'm doing is featuring some of the early podcasts that a lot of people haven't heard, but that are very good. In fact, the one that's coming up right now was the first interview show I did. It is my wife's favorite. And it features a really talented comic magician. In fact, he was Magician of the Year recently. This week and next week, there'll be some repeat shows from early in the podcast history, and then we'll be back with new shows in January. So I hope you enjoy this. Here comes this week's special re-release of my seventh show, The Magic of Hollywood. Enjoy! Hey, welcome, boys and girls. We have another great show for you this week. I am so excited. Sitting in front of me is one of my oldest friends in entertainment. He's not only a world-class magician, but he's a very funny guy. So he's a comic magician, and he's been working at my clubs for years. In fact, we just did a gig just a few months ago. But ladies and gentlemen, please make him feel welcome. It's Larry Wilson.
What a thunderous response that was. It's very flattering.
Hey, it's so great to have you here in this elaborate studio I'm using.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Larry Wilson, Magician of the Year, very, very funny guy. But we're talking about when we first met. So let's start off and introduce our audience to how you came about working for me. Do you remember?
Well, I remember very clearly because I'm one of the few people in entertainment who doesn't use any drugs or alcohol. So I have very clear memories of all these things.
You're the one.
I am the one guy. I am the one and only guy. No, there's a few guys who I remember, you know. It's quite a remarkable. The guys who are serious, the guys who take it seriously, I guess.
The professionals. And I always, we were just talking, appreciated working with
that's
people
what I think.
Took their trade professional.
I can't tell you the exact year, although I measure the timeline in ex-girlfriends. And so
that's a different way.
That's right. Well, so I can remember it now. So I can think of it. It must have been about 1979. Would that be right?
Well, I opened in 1980.
So it must have been
probably 80. Right about 1980, right. 81.
It was just in the beginning. It was in the Delta Queen.
You did work the original room.
I worked the original room a couple of times. I worked there because the fantastic, the illustrious, the esteemed George Wallace, I think, called you and said, oh, yeah, you know, you should have this guy Larry Wilson.
I got to tell you, I've already told this story a couple times in earlier podcasts, but I was so blessed that when I first got into the business, I visited an open mic at the Comedy Store in Westwood, which is no longer there. Dave Coulier was one of the acts. We got to talking. He introduced me to Bob Saget. The two of them introduced me to George Wallace, and it was George Wallace who ended up being my very first headliner in August 1980. And he was so nice. He took the time to answer all my questions about how to run a club, how to treat the comics, and introduced me to great entertainers like you.
He's the greatest. George Wallace, the greatest. And I had met George just from working at clubs in Los Angeles, and he was always very nice to me.
And a great entertainer that was actually had his own show in Vegas up until just last year.
Oh, I didn't realize he's not in Vegas.
He was performing at the Flamingo for over a decade, but he just gave up the show in the theater about 6 months ago.
I didn't realize. Well, George consistently, you know, I had a bunch of friends who worked at Showtime Cable, and I remember them telling me, at one time, they were editing this comedy competition that had taken place in New York. And they said, you should really see these two guys who are the two finalists. There's a guy named George Wallace and another guy named Jerry Seinfeld. And they said, they're both really, really funny. And of course, I watched and said, God, these guys are really funny. And an amazing thing happened while they were shooting. In the middle of George's set, there was a power outage.
No.
Everything went black.
Wow.
They were recording audio, but no picture. And they kept thinking, oh, it'll come on in a second. And so George does like 5 minutes in the dark. And the longer it goes on, the funnier it gets. And then finally, George is just silent for like a long stretch. And then he says, now when the lights come on, everyone yells surprise. And it brought the house down. I mean, it destroyed.
That's hilarious.
I thought, what incredible presence of mind in this. Clearly, you know you're taping for television. The whole thing's been disrupted. And
oh, that is a great story.
Totally, totally pro.
In all the years of owning the clubs, and I had three of them, we only had a couple blackouts or power outages. And I remember twice doing shows, we gave people in the audience flashlights.
Oh, that's funny.
And then the comics, there was no sound system, would just project
right
and get their act out there. But that's a great story about George, well, especially for a TV show.
Oh, my God. So anyway, it's because of George Wallace. And George Wallace, I mean, he didn't even say anything to me about it. You called me up and said, George Wallace said, you're really good, we should hire you. And I said, well, thank you very much. And so I came up as the middle act.
Well, it was interesting. I'm going to interrupt you briefly and just tell the audience that in the very beginning, I was copying clubs that were popular already in L.A., like the Comedy Magic Club. Mm-hmm. And so the very first, I'd say, 6-8 months of the shows, I had always had a magician or a ventriloquist or some creative act like that sandwiched or booked in by stand-ups. Mm-hmm. And I thought that brought a little bit more entertainment mm-hmm. and variety to the show. So that explains why you were a feature act, because you ended up being one of my regular headliners.
Well, here's what's so funny about that first time I came up, we were in the Delta Queen, which is essentially like a closet in this restaurant, but very nice. But it was like some side room or banquet room or something. It was like a big deal, and it was packed. Now, I owe a great debt to the guy who was the headliner, but I will not name him.
Okay.
I remember very clearly who it was. But I will not name him because I don't ever want to embarrass anyone. But it's interesting. He was one of those L.A. guys who I think was very talented but wasn't like really sure what he wanted to do. It's not clear if he wanted to do stand-up, or he wanted to be a writer, or he wanted to be an actor.
Well, we were talking earlier about Ed Solomon was used to come up and perform.
Yeah.
And an amazing writer, but he could not perform his way out of a paper bag. And I had several sit-downs with him saying, you know, you ought to become a writer. Of course, now he's a multimillionaire, world-famous writer
right.
of movies and TV. But so that's a great example. So what you're about to say, let me project.
Yes.
That you were funnier, and so we switched positions, possibly?
No. Never have occurred to me.
I've done that.
Well, I'm sure I've heard of such a thing happening, but I think he just, you know, I'm very high energy, and I think he was more laid back. And I think he also, you know, a lot of my early training, I don't know where some of this came from. I think from me studying performers that I admired, reading a lot and listening to people. So my understanding was you had to adapt to every audience.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But there's some people, especially this was an L.A. thing. There were guys who killed in L.A., killed at the Comedy Store, killed at the Improv, but died on the road. Because their stuff was either too hip or too edgy or whatever it was.
Well, you would see that a lot with acts coming out from New York.
Absolutely.
Definitely a different edge to a New York comic mm-hmm. or an East Coast comic than a West Coast comic. I know that sounds weird, but it was true.
Right.
And then you get out of the metropolitan areas and you get to playing where you're in Sacramento. And it's still a great audience. The people want to be entertained.
It's a fantastic
but it's
audience.
Different.
But they're just normal people, right, is
right.
what it is. And somehow it never occurred to me that you should make your act all about just pleasing the people in New York or LA. Now, maybe that's a brilliant strategy because some friends of mine who've done that have become, you know, enormously successful, obviously. But I didn't really think about that. I just thought, oh, you have to, you can't do, I mean, it's very funny. When I first met Jay Leno, who's also very, very nice to me, I worked with Jay a lot.
Good guy, yeah.
But Leno, I remember complimenting me after the first time he saw me, said, you know, it's very clever of you that you your act is so clean. And I said, oh, thank you. But I was thinking, what do you mean? Of course it has to be clean. Like, I didn't think you could go out and use four-letter words. I mean, I just thought, no one will hire you.
Well, what's interesting is back in the 80s and 90s, your goal was to get on TV, and it always cracked me up because some of these guys could not get through a set without, you know, 10 or 12 F-bombs. Right. But the guys that made it on TV and did The Tonight Show, Jerry Seinfeld, Jay Leno, Dana Carvey, Gary Shandling, they work clean.
Of course.
Now, there's some that could walk the fence. Bob Saget.
Saget.
was one of the guys that was one of the dirtiest comics you would ever hear.
And funny.
Yeah, and funny. And then he ends up on TV and as clean as could be.
Cleaner than clean, as like America's dad,
yeah.
You know, on that Full Out. Well, but I'll also tell you, I first met...
Oh, Allen.
Yeah, Tim Allen. I met Tim Allen in Detroit. I was working at a club there called the Comedy Castle.
Oh, yeah, I know it well.
And, you know, frequently when I would come into these places, they go, oh, you know, there's a local guy who's really, you got to meet him. And frequently I would think, okay, and then they would be terrible, right? You
know? Normally, yeah.
Right. But this, they were talking about, oh, this guy Tim Allen. So he came in and he killed. I mean, he was so great.
But a lot of people don't realize how filthy he was.
Well, so filthy. And he came up after us and he was very friendly and we were talking. I said, man, I said, you have everything you need, man. You could be a huge star. I said, you know, if you're interested, of course, in doing television, you'll have to try and clean that stuff up. And he just exploded. He just said, I don't want to do television. I don't have any interest in that, man. I'm going to be the greatest club comic here in the Detroit area. And I was just sort of like, okay, take it easy.
So funny how that was his beginning and how he ended up.
Isn't that weird?
But, and I'm sure there's other acts. I know some really funny people that never got famous because they were dirty and they couldn't adjust.
Right.
You know, Bob Saget was one of the best at doing both, and apparently Tim Allen was able to figure it out.
Of course.
But they learned to develop clean material because they wanted to do the Carson Show or something, Merv Griffin, and be able to do that. I want to tell a quick story,
yeah.
And then we got to get back to how you got started and stuff. I know we're going off on tangents, but we were talking about middle acts and headliners, mm-hmm. and how I always had magicians. So, and you'll get a kick out of this because it involves Goldfinger and Dove.
Love them.
So I was at the Magic Castle, and I see Goldfinger and Dove, and an amazing act.
Mm.
And I go backstage after I introduce myself. I go, look, I'd love to have you up to the club. And we booked them like 6 weeks out. And these guys are world-class magician team. And they come up. And we have our first show on Tuesday night, and we have an opening act, a feature act, and here comes Goldfinger and Dove, and they do the same exact beautiful act. It lasts 15 minutes. Well, I'm like freaking out because headliners are normally good for 45 minutes to an hour. That's what's budgeted in the show to entertain the audience. And they get done and go, thank you, good night. And I'm literally in the bar and I'm running up and I grab the feature act and I go back up and do some more time because these people paid for a 2-hour show, right? So what we did is starting the second night, they were the middle act. But they were getting headliner pay.
Right.
But it was a great lesson for me because whenever you hire somebody, hey, by the way, how much time can you do?
Right. Well, because variety acts in general come from a tradition where they're thinking, oh, you're going to be in a review show where you do 8 or 9 minutes, or you're going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show where you'll do 3 minutes or four. I mean, the idea was, and there were variety acts. One of my favorite ventriloquists of all time, a guy named Sammy King.
I don't know him.
He He's unbelievable. His act is so brilliantly structured. It's like a pyramid. It's just 9 minutes. The first 4.5 minutes is going up to the top of the pyramid. There's a lot of jokes. He has a parrot named Francisco, and the parrot's funny, and a lot of jokes. But you don't realize what it's really doing at the midpoint, the exact midpoint. He and the parrot get into an argument, and he puts the parrot back in its cage and covers it. The second half is him trying to play guitar, a flamenco guitar, but the parrot keeps interrupting him.
And heckling him.
Except we don't see the parrot.
Oh, that's hilarious.
We just hear the parrot's voice. But the character was so strong, and he looks over at the cage when the parrot interrupts him and says, please, you know. His entire second half of the act is like a bobsled going downhill, where the first half set up all these callbacks. And the, anyways,
that's
Sammy.
That's genius.
Well, so I hired Sammy when I was producing a show at one point. And, you know, I said, I knew that he didn't do a lot of time, but I said, Sammy, so, you know, I have all the people, I have a comedy ventriloquist, comedy juggler, comedy magician. I said, we're all doing like 15-minute sets. I said, can you do longer than 9 minutes? I said, can you stretch it? He goes, yeah. Yeah, he said, I could stretch to 10.
He was basically going to talk slower.
And I said, to 10. He goes, yeah. He goes, but you know what? It's better at 9. And so I said, you know what? Stick with 9. Just stick with 9.
Well, I learned my lesson. We never ended up booking Goldfinger and Dove again because they were expensive world-class magicians.
Of course,
they're
incredible.
You can't pay that kind of money for a 15-minute set. But it was interesting because for the audience out there that wouldn't know this, that in the comedy world, different than what you're talking about, the vaudeville shows, TV and radio, where you have short segments, we were always filling a 2-hour show.
Right.
Between 3 acts. And so you had to balance between how much time the MC did, which, you know, should be just a few minutes, wasn't my case, an opening act that might do 10 minutes, feature act does maybe 20, and then the headliner would cover between 40 and an hour.
Sure.
And that was pretty standard in the stand-up world, in the comedy club world. But that's really totally different than all the other types of entertainment that you might do. And at the time, I didn't really even realize it was that different, but it makes total sense now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
well, here's what's so funny, Scott. So, like so many things that have happened in my career, it was all serendipity. I didn't know what was going on. I had no clue. I just thought, this is really fun, and as long as it continues, I'm going to go along for the ride, right? So, George Wallace, I meet him. He's nice enough to call you, so I get booked. So I come up, the headliner is having trouble following me. I wouldn't say anything about it. I didn't want him to feel awkward or bad. That's why I won't say who it was. But you, it would never have occurred to me to go to you and say, you should, but you came to me and said, we'd like to bring you back as a headliner. And I thought,
because I'm a genius and I recognize genius.
Obviously you are. But my attitude was, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, but when I think of all the people who would not have done that, who would have thought, oh, you know, how can I exploit this? Or how can I, right?
Oh, you mean keep you as a low, right, lesser paid?
Or whatever.
Oh, no, I was all about the quality of the show. One of the reasons I don't have money is that I never was trying to make a buck off the show. I was really in the industry for my love of the industry, of the comedy world.
Well,
and which sounds ridiculous. Obviously, I made money in the 80s and 90s, but I wasn't gouging at the door.
It's obvious that's why you had so much success. I remember talking with you in the beginning, and I was so impressed that you and Bob had decided to open this comedy club because you really like stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And I thought, God, that's a weird idea.
It's like, well, it wasn't smart business-wise, but we certainly had a good time.
Well, what else are we going to do? I mean, in the final analysis, I'm here with you today because of our relationship, because we have an authentic bond, right? So is that somehow less valuable? I think that's all there is, these connections we have. I think that's all we have.
Well, I think it's interesting that you point that out, because one of the big lessons I learned from working with George Wallace's first few weeks and people like Bob Saget and Dave Coulier was treat the comics well. Don't overpay them. Don't expect, you know, there's people going to take advantage and stuff. But treat them respectfully, and you'll get that back. And that was always kind of my mantra in the early days. So let's back up a little bit. When did you start doing magic?
Oh, I guess when I was very small. And it's funny, I guess, because people sometimes will ask me, they think, oh, was your father a magician? No, my father, nobody in my family had anything to do with show business. They were horrified, all of this stuff. But I remember my father must have shown me some little magic trick when I was a kid. And then I just did it. I think a lot of kids get interested in magic, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old and stuff. But I never thought of doing it.
So what was your first show? Were you, like, doing the kids' shows or high school, or was it college that you kind of did a public set?
No, I'll tell you, it's funny. I, just for fun, in Southern California, I was in Los Angeles, a friend of mine took me to the Renaissance Fair.
Oh, and used to go to those.
Yeah, and so somebody said, oh, you could do this, Larry. And I thought, oh, that'll be fun. So I started just as a street performer, passing the hat. And I was enormously successful. And it was really interesting training because I didn't have any pretensions.
No, and
I just wanted to have fun, and I also saw that when the audience was really entertained, I got more money in the hat.
So did that lead to the comedy joining the magic? Because not every magician is funny.
Right. Well, no, I couldn't separate them ever from the beginning.
Okay, so you started off kind of as a comic magician.
Well, because to me, the idea of being a magician, you're saying, I have supernatural powers. That's already funny, right?
Yeah.
But then you say, I'm going to demonstrate my supernatural powers by changing this red scarf into a blue scarf.
Ooh.
Right. Now, if you had supernatural powers, is that what you'd be using them for? It's already inherently absurd, the idea. It's obviously a theatrical conceit saying, I have supernatural powers. So to me, that's already a funny character. And that's what I played on stage all these years and still do, is the character who really thinks that he can convince the audience of his supernatural abilities.
Oh, it always cracked me up. And some guys played on it and other guys were like dead serious magicians where they're changing a $1 bill into a $20 bill and trying to wow the audience like this is real, like, hello.
Right.
If I could do this, I wouldn't be here entertaining you.
Why would I be here? I'd be at home changing all these ones into hundreds, right? Yeah. Of course. You know, anyway, that to me is already funny. And so I could never, ever do it straight. I could never, ever do it as straight magic. And so so I was doing these Renaissance fairs, but just for fun. I never took that seriously. I was then I went to UC Santa Cruz, where I got a degree in filmmaking.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
How cool.
And that was always my love, is filmmaking and storytelling, which, of course, is interesting because it's what I do.
Well, that's similar to a patter, which it's called when a magician's doing his act, is there's what's called patter, which is a description of the act, basically.
Right.
But it's a story if you're doing it right.
But there's even more than that. When you start to break film down, you realize it's just like magic.
Oh, interesting.
It's just like magic. When you're editing and you see someone in a wide shot reach for something on the shelf, and then we cut to a close-up and we see, oh, it's a coin they're picking up, right? Well, that's exactly like a magician. You have a greater advantage in film because I can focus your attention. But it's about directing your attention to what I want you to see.
Yeah, you control what the audience sees.
Right. You know how in film we do a cutaway, you know, someone walks through a door and then we cut to the other side of them coming out. Well, it doesn't mean the doorway's the same location, right?
Right.
It's exactly like magic. And it's no surprise that certain great filmmakers like Orson Welles, huge magic fan.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, my God.
But what, it does make sense what you're saying is, I mean, there's the term movie magic for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first magicians, the first filmmakers, Georges Méliès, Frenchman, the first filmmaker in Paris, he was a stage magician.
I saw a TV special about him. Didn't he do the movie Man in the Moon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
and,
of course.
And that and, was all tricks.
Well, Scorsese's film Hugo.
But not on film.
Yes, Scorsese's film Hugo is about Georges Méliès and his origins, and he realized, and it's typical of magicians, he just saw this film medium as a way to do his magic act better. You know, you could do all these tricks. You could shoot him walking on stage, then stop the camera, move someone off, start the camera, and they would appear to disappear in the film, right?
Exactly.
So all these, there's a huge, huge history in film of effects artists who are also magicians.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes perfect sense. And I didn't know you had a degree in that, and Santa Cruz is a wonderful university.
Oh, yeah.
And but so you were already performing.
Well, but I stopped performing when I went to college because I was serious about filmmaking. So I get out of Santa Cruz. I come back to L.A. Everyone's just graduated from film school.
That's true in L.A.
Yeah, there's no jobs. I mean, I have all these friends who are very talented who are all fighting for jobs. They don't get paid. They're fighting for these jobs where you work for free. And I'm thinking, how am I supposed to support myself if I'm working for free? In the midst of all this, I get a job on a low-budget film. I'm getting paid $175 a week, working 6 days a week, 16 hours a day.
Wow. That's and like I opening
thought,
act pay.
Well, I thought I was killing it because I had all these friends who were working for nothing, right? But after a couple weeks, I mean, I was pretty fried by this, right? And I ran into someone who said, oh, hey, how you doing? What's going on? I said, well, I'm doing all this stuff. They said, do you do magic anymore? And I was like, oh, no. I'm just filmmaking now. And they said, oh, that's too bad. And I said, why? And they said, well, my parents are going to have a party. They're going to hire a magician. And I just thought, you know, if you, I said, well, hold on a second. I said, what were they going to pay? He said, I don't know, $600-$700. I said, I could do that. Right? He said, oh, really? I said, yeah, of course I could. So I go home. I get out all my old stuff. I sort of brush up on stuff. I go to this party. To my astonishment, everyone loved it. And then people were asking for my business card. I said, you know, I just ran out of cards, but I'm going to write my name and number on this napkin for you. Suddenly, I'm doing all these parties. I thought,
oh, Larry,
this
that's great.
Is great. Then at one of these parties, someone says, would you like to be on TV? I said, well, what do you mean? They said, I'm the talent director for, and I don't remember what it was, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Dinah Shore, something, one of those
you
shows.
You did all those shows.
Oh, yeah. And I said, well, would I get paid? They said, well, of course you get paid. I said, oh, yeah, I'd do it, right? So I do that show. A couple days later, I get a call from someone else that goes, you know, my brother-in-law is a talent coordinator for that show you just did. They said you did really well and you're really nice and easy to work with. And again, it wouldn't occur to me to not be professional or not be nice or not, you know.
I'm going to interrupt you just to say that I've known you a long time and you are one of the most driven, high energy car salesmen of the entertainment industry. I mean, you really, when you get on stage, you're on. And you have a dynamic personality. And what's interesting in hearing how you got started is you kind of just fell into things.
Yes.
As opposed to now where you're really driven. I mean, all the years I've known you, you were out there getting the gigs and selling yourself. So to hear that this is how you started is fascinating.
I had no idea what I was doing, Scott. I had no clue. And so most people start out in clubs and work up to television. I sort of started in television. And all these people who knew each other were referring me to each other. I was doing all these TV shows. And so it's I have a totally different perspective on all of it.
That's fascinating.
I mean, it's crazy.
I had no idea.
Well, also because my background, I think because of film and stuff like that, all of it I'm looking at as a theatrical experience. And nowadays, there seems to be something else going on that's different that I'm not familiar
with. But you did it right, and one of the things that I think helped you, whether you knew it or not, and I'm not sure at what point you decided to become this character, Larry Wilson the Magician, but you had an iconic look with the white tuxedo, the hair was perfect. I mean, you were on, like I said, and whether it was television or a comedy club stage, the audience knew that, one, you were a professional, two, you had the look, and then, like I said, you had the energy and the, I call it salesmanship, but, you know, like you could have sold refrigerators to an Eskimo, as they would say.
Well,
you had the patter, the talk.
Well, I always, again, I looked to show business icons. I would read about these people, and I think of James Cagney, who said, "You should always be dressed a little better than the audience."
Oh, that's great.
Right?
I've never heard that.
Oh, yeah. And so I thought, I said, well, of course this makes sense. So I that white tuxedo I had purchased at the MGM auction. There was a rack of them. There must have been 50 of them. And I remember at the time, friends of mine said, "You're crazy. Why would you buy this?" I said, "I don't know. It just seems like it's fun, right?" But it was very expensive, Scott. It cost $7.
Oh, jeez.
And my friend said, you're crazy. You're throwing $7.
Hopefully you bought more than one.
Well, there's now been like 18 or 19 of them because I had the original one I bought must have been 40 years old when I bought it. But it was beautifully made, right? And I wore it just as a laugh because somebody at one point said, "Oh, we really want you in a tux." So I said, okay.
Oh, really? So right. This wasn't a persona you picked.
No, it was asked
for. That's interesting.
No. And of course, I didn't have any shoes to go with the white tux, so I just wore my white Adidas. And then the first time I performed, someone came up to me and said, "It's so brilliant of you, the tuxedo with tennis shoes. You're showing..."
I always thought that was cool.
Of course, people said, "Oh, the juxtaposition of modern versus..." They interpreted all these things that I didn't realize. I said,
just did it because you had them.
Right. I said, "Yeah, I'm a genius, aren't I?" Right. But the look of me with the hair and beard, that was very intentional because I thought, the character I'm playing is supposed to look like a magician.
And it really worked. Now, do you remember what year you started wearing the tux? Because that is the character that it was, you know, Merv Griffin, the Donna.
Oh, that was
Diana
that was,
Shore show.
Yes. Oh, that was before any of the TV stuff. That was doing these private parties.
Wow.
I probably
and
did.
It just you stayed with it.
Oh yeah, because what
and
became
to this day?
Well, I still, of course, because it's become a very clear trademark. That, you know, when you and I were doing this, the rule of thumb was you had to be on television like 20 or 30 times before people would remember your name. Now, with the inundation of media, I don't know how many times you have to appear before people before they remember your name. I don't know. But
it really is a different world. You're leading into a statement that I could make is that in the show business in the 80s and the 90s, you were correct. You could do a bunch of those other shows. Merv Griffin is a great example. Mm-hmm. And if you did them enough, you became a household name. And then it changed to when if you did one Tonight Show with Carson as the host and you rocked it.
Yes.
You were an overnight celebrity.
Yes.
But then in the 90s, that kind of faded. And for some reason, Letterman didn't like having comics on, probably because he was a comic. And Leno didn't really support comedy when he was running The Tonight Show. So it shifted to where it took a lot of little shows. Then it was, wow, if you got Carson, you were made. And then it went back to, you could do these shows and nobody will ever really remember because there's so much going
on. Oh, my God. I mean, I can tell you this. I see stuff posted on YouTube that I didn't put up of me, of shows I don't remember doing. So they're all. But do you remember seeing Johnny Yoon on The Tonight Show?
Yes.
I remember it as if it were yesterday.
And I would not know that name any other way.
Johnny Yoon, first Korean comic to appear on The Tonight Show, goes on, kills. I mean, just destroyed them. Carson's going crazy. 6 weeks later, I see Johnny Yoon's name on the marquee at the Sands in Vegas.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that's what it was in those days. You went on Carson and killed. It just took one shot. Yeah. That was it. You
well,
know?
And we know lots of people, Leno, Gary Shandling, Seinfeld, that went on and had those moments mm-hmm. that changed their lives.
Right. But they, even those guys, had to keep performing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but it's a different world. And so I guess what made me think of that was, I don't always expect people to remember my name, but they certainly remember the white tux, the beard and hair. They
no, right.
That
the
image,
look, like
they
I
remember.
Said, it was iconic. You definitely put it down. Let's transition a little bit. One of the things that made you who you are was not only you're a terrific magician, and you can do both close-up and stage acts, and I know that you do huge stage productions in Reno, Tahoe, and Vegas. So I've seen you from a staged 3-foot by 3-foot square all the way up to a huge theatrical performance. But the comedy has always worked for you. Can you share with the audience, since we're kind of a comedy podcast about stand-up, some of the early bits? And there's ones that I mentioned to you before we went on the air that we always remember. But maybe you could share a couple.
See, it's complicated because to me, I would write comedy. I would sometimes write stand-up material that I would do on stage just for fun because I wanted to try it out. But the stuff that I like the best really had to do where it came organically from the magic that I was doing. I presented something in a funny way. But what you're saying is, you know, it's funny. I wrote maybe 30 minutes of stand-up that I would do on stage sometimes. I would almost be my own opening act where I would use that, because when I was traveling a lot, I found that when I was traveling, especially through the South, I could make fun of where I was from. I'd say, oh, I'm from Los Angeles. And immediately they would respond to that going, yeah, you seem different, you know. And so then I could just tell them things about where I was from. And that was hysterical to them. And a lot of it weren't jokes. I was telling them
true stuff. Well, for example, you flew around in the South in what airline?
On the Ozark Airline. I don't think they're around anymore. And I just told them, I said, you know, there's all these things in the South that are new to me. And I think maybe some comics come and would try to make fun of people in the South, which, of course, doesn't make sense to me. But instead, I would embrace them and say, I'm learning all this new stuff, but I'd never flown on this airline, Ozark. And, you know, I had the ticket in my pocket there. You could read Ozark. And I went into the bathroom to wash my hands. I looked up in the mirror, and there it was, reversed, Crazo. I thought, I don't want to be on Crazo Air. Right. And so that's not that hilarious a joke, but in the South, oh my God, they thought, because no one was saying stuff about them, no one was relating. And I would talk about it. I said, you know, it's hard for me to understand sometimes when you speak, because I can tell everyone's really friendly, they're smiling, but it just sounds like they've taken all the consonants out of the alphabet. Just, I said, I'm being diphthonged to death by you people. I said, but they're lovely people. I said, but sometimes they offer me things. I don't know what they are, you know?
Well, there's a famous treat that you're known for. So you're flying around the South on Crazo Airlines, and you're introduced to this new treat. Tell us about this.
Well, because they said I was at some place and I ate at a restaurant, and this woman said, "Oh, would you like a moon pie?" And I thought, I don't know what that is, a moon pie. And she said, "Oh, it's just like a goo goo." And I said, "Goo goo? No. I don't know. You know." And again, these are simple jokes. It's like
Well, they're not jokes in the sense of a setup and a punchline.
Right, right.
You're experiencing
right.
something in the South. And it always worked. It's one of the bits that we've never forgotten. Crazo Airlines and Moon Pie. One was the way you expressed it. And two, that we'd never, as Californians, had never heard of moon pie.
Right.
Well, but you know, or a goo-goo.
It's also funny. I think it because I approached it theatrically, where I wasn't just transmitting this information. I was really performing theatrically, like you felt like this is Larry's confusion. You know, I think I gave the idea of how weird it felt to me to be a stranger in a strange land.
Well, I also, it leads me to explain to the audience that one of the really great talents and why some of these comics become actors is that, and you were doing this naturally, was that you're telling these stories like it just happened. And the audience doesn't know that you've been telling that same story every show for, you know, 365 days
right.
on stage, but we're able to sell it like, oh, by the way,
well,
I was just in the South and had a moon pie.
You know, you put your finger right on it, Scott. Again, this is how, why I think, it was not my intention, but it clearly, in retrospect, is sort of what makes me different than some of these other performers, because I was approaching it theatrically. You know, I became very good friends with Carl Malden, you know, the Academy Award-winning actor. And he was, every single performance he did, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront and on. I mean, the guy's...
Very dramatic.
Brilliant, brilliant. And one time I just said to him, I said, I can't take it anymore. I keep watching these films. Every time you're different, every time you're great, I can't see what you're doing. Can you? He said, I don't know what you mean. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, well, I'm just learning the material so well that I don't have to think about it, that I can just...
So he really studied.
Exactly.
And became the character, and then it became natural, so it wasn't like even acting, it was real.
And then after he had passed away, his daughter showed me this copy of a script of one of his. And, you know, on the right side is the script page, and the left side is usually blank. Left side, every single page, covered in handwritten notes about every single line of what's going on. I remember one time I asked him, I said, can you tell the difference between good actors and bad actors? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. I said, really? I said, how do you tell? He said, well, he said, a good actor... Even if, you know, Carl had done all this work for years on Broadway, right? He said, even if you're in a Broadway show doing 8 performances a week for years, they're listening to you as if they've never heard what you're about to say, as if they're thinking, how do I process? What is, you know, they said, a bad actor is just thinking, when will it be my turn to speak? Right? And so when
huge you, difference.
Right. When you talk about saying to the audience, like, oh, I just thought of this, every single performance is like, oh, you know what? I just thought of this.
Right. And to the audience, it's the first time, so that's a legitimate conversation.
Of course it is. But it's also, this is what theater is. I don't know if stand-up is really theater. I think it should be. But that's what theater is. When we see Hamlet, we don't seriously believe the person on stage is a Danish prince, right? Because if he was, he'd be speaking Danish. He wouldn't be speaking English. But the theatrical conceit, we suspend our disbelief.
Wow.
You know?
That's very well put. Well, you know, we're talking about communication here. That leads us to what you're doing now. So I've already explained to the audience that Larry Wilson's not only a very successful comic magician that's worked television in stages of all sizes for decades, but just recently you've taken some of what you've learned about communication and started kind of a side project that's really more than a side project. It's a business.
Well, it's kind
of... Let's tell the audience about it.
It's kind of taking over my life. A few years ago, after a performance, a guy came up and introduced himself. His name is Al Oppenheim. He's the professor, the Ford professor of engineering at MIT. And he said, you know, you're a really, really good communicator. And I said, oh, thank you. He said, could I hire you to come to MIT and teach our graduate students to improve their communications? I said, sure, of course.
Well, that's a compliment right there.
Well, it was a lovely thing, and I thought, well, great. So I came and did this presentation for MIT students, and they were fantastic. They're brilliant. But they didn't have great communication skills. And they were so enthusiastic. And afterwards, Professor Oppenheim said to me, he said, you know what, you're a great entertainer, but this is what you should really be doing now.
Wow.
And I said, are you serious? He said, yeah.
Had to be kind of interesting to hear as a lifelong entertainer, which, you know, you've honed your craft to the level that of excellence that it is, and then being told, well, yeah, that's okay, but you should be doing this.
Well, it was mind-blowing because he said, you're not even aware, I think, that you illustrated so many of the techniques you're teaching with stories about show business icons you learned this from. I said, well, yeah, you know, I work with people like Sammy Davis Jr. and Ann Margaret, and, you know, it goes on and on and on, all these people, and so many Academy Award-winning people, and the biggest stars in the world.
And you learn from each and every one of them.
I would pay attention to every single one.
Smart.
He said, you don't realize what you're doing is so interesting. He said, because you're not trying to teach people to be talented. I said, well, no, I don't know how to teach anyone to be talented. He said, you're teaching them technique. I said, well, yeah, technique is duplicatable. I can transfer technique to anyone. If you speak English, it doesn't have to be your first language, but if you speak English, I can teach anyone to communicate better and more effectively. And that led to this development of this thing I now call Wilson Method Training. I do training for corporate events for, you know, half day for big companies. I do a very intensive 2-day boot camp. But that's very small because it's very personalized coaching. It's limited to just 10 people. But that mostly are individuals, although some people from some companies have now called me recently because I think they want their execs to come to that. And then I've also just completed a online, like a masterclass training online so that people who cannot travel to wherever I am or something like that.
And this, and you can find all this on your website, www.wilsonmethod.com. And so I got to ask, so when you do these presentations,
yeah,
is it in a white tux?
No. It's very, very...
it's different than your show performance.
It's very jarring for people who know me as the white tux guy because I dress like a professional in a suit, a dark suit and tie. And, you know, the next question you may ask, I don't do any magic, of course, because I want to emphasize, I want to make it really clear to people who are training with me, I don't want to do anything that you think, well, I could never do that.
Oh, right, like magic.
Right.
You know, teaching magic, which you could probably do,
sure,
is not what we're trying to get accomplished here. We're trying to teach communication,
exactly,
which is not as physically oriented, right?
Right. Well, I'll give you an example here. There's so many, it's terrifying. I started to put together a collage of photos of famous people I'd work with. And when it got to like 70 or 80, I thought, this is a lot of people. And each one of them is a distinct lesson. A classic a tenet of Wilson Method. I learned from Hugh Hefner.
Oh, really?
A girl I knew took me to a party at the Playboy Mansion many years ago. Yes. Crowded party, fantastic, very exciting, you know. And she said, oh, I really want you to meet Hef. And I thought, you know what? Hef doesn't want to meet me. And she said, no, he's great. You'll love him. And I thought, okay, all right, I'll go. So she drags me over. And he says, "Oh, hi, you know, Debbie has been telling me, you know, about you." And I said, "Oh, it's really nice to meet you." And he says, "She says you just graduated from college." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "What was your major?" And I said, "Filmmaking." And he said, "Oh, do you like film noir? And it's a genre of film, right?" I said, "I love film noir." He said, "Do you like The Bad and the Beautiful?" I said, "You mean the greatest film noir ever made?" He said, "Isn't it incredible?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Isn't Gloria Graham the most luminous woman you've ever seen on screen?" I said, "Yes, yes." I said, "Now tell me something, Hef. Why didn't she become a big star?" He said, "Well, I think she didn't look like big stars at the time, like Rita Hayworth, you know? Like Gloria Graham sort of had a different shaped face, and she was blonde, and her eyes, you know." I said, "But anyway, the next thing I know, Scott, I'm standing in the middle of this party talking to him for like 40 minutes about film. And I suddenly realize all these people are crowded around us who are looking like they'd like to wring my neck, right?" And so I said, "You know what, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to monopolize your time." I said, "But this is fantastic, and I just want to thank you for inviting me to the party. It was great. It was great to meet you." And he said, "Thanks." And then I disengaged myself. I walked away, and I thought, "Oh, I understand why this guy's had such incredible success with women." I said, "I get it totally. Because he's actively listening."
He's engaged.
But there's a technique that everyone can use, Scott. He is engaged. You're right. But what he did that I teach, I think is a very important thing, is he really listened to me, and his responses indicated that he was listening to me. Didn't mean he had to agree with me. Didn't mean he had to flatter me. I think what we want more than anything in life is to feel like we're seen and heard. I think there's nothing worse than feeling like you're invisible. Okay. If you've ever had that experience, for whatever reason, you don't have enough money, or you're not in the right club, or you're not in the right clothes, or whatever it is, it's a terrible feeling. And when someone really sees you and really hears you, it creates an authentic bond with them. Now, sometimes people say to me, "Well, you know, what if you weren't in film? What if it was something he didn't know about?" I guarantee you what he would have said. If I'd said, "Oh, I'm an astrophysicist," if he didn't know anything about astrophysics, he might have said to me, "Oh, I don't know anything about that. Can you tell me what's the most..." Yeah,
that's a great lesson.
Oh, my God.
And you know what it brings to mind, though, is that people out there in the audience have a choice. You could go out and spend several hundred thousand on therapy, or just go to the Wilson method.
Oh, my God. I mean, I have a certain bias, of course, because I think so highly of myself. But I have to
tell you... Well deserved.
I have to tell you honestly, Scott. And I thought, wow, that's... To me, that's more important.
Well, plus, once you learn something like that, it's not just for business. It becomes who you are, and it helps in all your relationships, whether it's family, friends, or business. That's fascinating. Folks, don't be afraid. Check it out, www.wilsonmethod.com. You know what? Sadly, we're running out of time. But Larry, I can't tell you how exciting it was for me to have you join me in the studio.
That's great, man.
And chat about show business and where you've how you got started to where you are now. I don't even need, but I will wish you continued success.
Thank
because
you.
In all the years I've known you, as I mentioned, you are the adamant professional and always rising to the occasion. And just with the Wilson method, I think you're going to take this to the next level. Congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, sometimes people say to me in the training, they'll say, you know, "Do you think this is bad, or do you think this is a mistake?" I said, "You know, I think the only thing that's really a failure is death." I said, "As long as you don't die,
you're doing it okay.
I think you're doing great." And you know,
that's a great response.
Well, it's true, because sometimes we'll be talking. We do a lot of training for people who have to get up, make presentations or speeches, and of course, people are terrified of doing that. And when we break it down and deconstruct it, they realize, "Oh, I don't have to be afraid." And suddenly, these people are able to get up, effortlessly and speak extemporaneously, and it's fantastic transformation. But I just say, no one's ever died from being embarrassed.
Yeah, or stage fright.
Or stage
fright. People have it, and yeah.
Never died.
Perspective. That's the word of the day, perspective.
Isn't that the truth?
Larry, thanks so much. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Larry Wilson for joining us today. Stay tuned for a future podcast. Be sure to review them, rate them, and share them. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much. It's fantastic, man.
You guys have a great day. Thanks. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.